very moved by, I think, like most of you, I think, have read the novels of Marilynne Robinson, and the Archbishop's words were just deeply moving. They were also something that inspired thought. I'll be very brief, but this notion of unreconciled irony versus reconciled irony does remind me of a novel that we both love, Karamazov, which is a novel of homecoming. These three guys have been away, and they come back to visit their... It couldn't be a father more different than John Ames and Fyodor. Yvonne's problem to the end, he justifies himself to himself. He doesn't go and make confession to the prosecutor when he could. He's very satisfied justifying himself to himself. Whereas Alyosha goes and is received as a guest by Grushenka, expects one thing, finds another, and finds grace. They both do. Grace can't be planned. It's the unpredictable arrival of absolution that they give to each other. And just one last thought, reconciled irony, is there at the end of Karamazov, if you remember the scene where Dmitri looks at his brother Alyosha and says, "We're talking like a couple of Jesuits now, aren't we?" And Alyosha laughs, and he laughs, and the irony is a moment of grace. It's a moment of liberated grace for Dmitri. I'm stopping there. I'm going to open things up now to questions, because there must be many. John. Now, John, what I'm going to do is, if you can project...
Well, Bill, I have a question about the biblical affirmation, there is a bomb in Gilead, and especially its echo in the African-American spiritual song, there is a bomb in Gilead that heals the sin sick. So there's a bomb in Gilead that makes the wounded whole. My question is this. I don't quite see how it relates to Gilead or home, but I think it somehow does. And do you have any reflection on that?
Mm. Thank you. Very interesting question, which has occurred, I think, to a number of readers. Clearly, the name of the town is not accidental. It's not contingent. And I'm sure that for exactly the reason of that spirituals opening line, it's a deliberate allusion. But what is the balm? Gilead begins its life as a town in the context of the anti-slavery struggle. It's a place of balm. It's a place of refuge. And in forgetting, as Ames says, the question at its heart, it ceased to be that place. It ceased to be a welcoming place for the stranger. The sin-sick soul cannot actually live there any longer. So that's, I think, why Ames says explosively at one point in his narrative, there is no truth in this town. The name is the name of a fiction, I think.
Another question from Hal. Who else has a question so we can kind of be prepared? Okay, well, get from the similar bit, Hal.
Great, I get to ask a question. That's good. The one I always want to ask about Gilead, I've never gotten a good answer, so you're really on the spot.
No pressure.
I want to know why, and I actually wrote a letter to Marilynne Robinson. She didn't answer my letter. But many people don't answer my letter. Why do you think that John Ames gives him the book of Feuerbach as the parting gift? Interesting choice.
Very. I haven't a clue. Possibly Marilynne Robinson hasn't either. Maybe that's why she didn't answer. Authors never know what they mean by their books, as you know. That's why we have to tell them. Thinking hard. It's partly the family history, isn't it?
Yes.
It's therefore a bit of an affirmation that Ames sees Jack as in his own family succession, that extraordinary dynastic story of, if you like, the theological quarrels of the 19th and 20th centuries swinging like a pendulum through the family. He's part of that. And I wonder if it's also part of the fact that Feuerbach, for so many 19th century Christians, was, if you like, the question. And very much what Barth, of course, is pushing back against as hard as he can. It's almost as if he's saying to Jack, I trust you with the question. If you're not going this way, you've got to have a reason. If you're not collapsing the divine and the human into one another, remember that that implicitly says something about the divine, about the terror of the divine that Bart talks about. Maybe it's a little bit of that. I'm guessing.
Yes. I have one, I mean, I'll hold it in reserve. Please, Sarah, your question.
Theology was the object and subject of your talk, in the sense that Calvin sort of is part of the story, and of course, he's your own meta narrative with respect to the ordinance of grace. I want to get back to Dostoevsky. If the way in which you construct grace as you thematize the novel comes from Bart or ultimately comes from Calvin, why, if you compare that with Dostoevsky, who also has a notion of grace, who also has bafflement and gratitude when you're driven out of these things, what difference with a theology which is the object and subject to some extent, both inside the text and outside the text, what difference would that make? What difference would that make so that we respect our understanding?
Oh, I think I probably need another lecture or so for that. Let me think. I suppose that I'm trying to explore in the whole of this venture something about what the narrative shape of grace is. The narrative shape of grace fits awkwardly onto an awkwardly but constructively onto a number of different theologies. Ames reads the Bart and the Calvin that he reads. And I've read, or tried to read, the Bart and the Calvin that Ames is reading, so to speak, in my observations. And I think it's because Ames' own theological place in the books is very much shaped by his own sense of the narrative he's inherited in the town and in the family. So, thinking across for a moment to Dostoevsky, I suppose, again, Dostoevsky is in all sorts of ways looking for a narrative of the grace that he sees in retrospect as literally saving his life and his language. I'm not sure where entirely he goes for his theology of it in his own case. Fussy Russian Orthodox, there are some, will say that, of course, Zosima is not at all an Orthodox theologian. Actually, he is in many important respects, but there was, as you'll know, a great controversy about that in the late 19th century, and there still is in some circles. So, I don't know, I'm really just thinking out loud about all this, but I think I'd trace it back to that question of how a particular narrative of grace as seen in history, in individual history, a corporate history, casts this particular light on the theological discourse in which you're working. Hence, as then my effort to read what Ames is reading, to read over his shoulder.
You know, actually, you asked the question that I was kind of thinking of, but I think it comes to the question of freedom. Usually Russian Orthodox, like Catholics, will speak of cooperation with grace, exactly what Bard is rejecting. And what you're offering, and those who celebrate Dostoevsky would celebrate that too. When you think of Bakhtin, I mean, unfinalizability is all about freedom of the characters and a kind of cooperating with grace. But what was so interesting is when you talked about Calvin's doctrine of predestination as actually opening up freedom, and I guess the way I was going to pose the question, I've celebrated Archbishop Williams rightly as someone who is somebody very important in ecumenical dialogue. And this seems to be a place where Calvinists from Catholics and Orthodox find this common celebration of freedom that's, you know, at the heart of it. But it comes at it in a different way.
Absolutely. And I think, again, I'm reading over Marilyn Robinson's shoulder here, because I've found her reflections on Calvin among the most interesting things she's written, in a way, because I think she's trying to say there is no way in which you can make a theology worth the name out of a collaboration that implies, ultimately, two agents occupying the same semantic, ontological, etc. space. If they don't, then where does the finite freedom come from? The Calvinist, and I think not only the Calvinist, but also to some extent the Augustinian and Thomist answer, is finite freedom exists not in its own right as a sort of empty self-determining capacity. It exists because of alignment with an infinite freedom, which is the freedom to be what God infinitely is. That is...
Balthasar, too. Yes.
Well, you took the words out of my mouth.
Oh, sorry,
yes, it's
exactly. And his first book is on Bart and, you know,
right.
The priesthood prayer that will all be one. It strikes me as a deep commonality there that would help us to see. Other questions about anything? Please.
I'm sorry it's so hot in here. I congratulate you on staying awake, most of you.
My thought didn't quite keep up with your speech. Could you say again and maybe more elaborately the characteristics of the new speaking?
Thank you. Thank you very much. Yes, the characteristics of native speaking, because I think what struck me as I was thinking around this subject and kind of flicking through the novels to see where it was coming together, was just that native speaking theme. Jack thinks he can't speak the native language of his family, his environment, and those around him feel similarly, that he's somehow not a native speaker. And he's always, in his encounters in the novels, so conscious of how other people hear him that he can barely speak in his own right. Now, what that led me into was looking at the two very divergent ways in which Jack and Lila move in the novels. Jack never arrives at a place where he can speak from himself because of this crippling attention to how he's heard. And so it's an endless irony. I can never be at home in my words. So he can't arrive at that point of native speaking, and he's faced with a model of native speaking, which is his father's and his family's, which is that you inhabit what you say without ever asking any questions about it. Yep. What strikes me about Lila is her ability to inhabit what she says and ask questions. I've been seeing these so long, I'm, you know, getting to enjoy it. She has that genuinely wry self-acceptance of acceptance of where she is, which still says, I know this is slightly absurd, but as I said at the end, I can cope with it because it still leaves room for change and absolution. And that's another kind of native speaking. That's not a native speaking that's all about sameness, identity, and the defense that goes with it, but a native speaking that says, I don't have to be anxious about where I belong because that's taken out of my hands by grace.
Grace, have time for one more question, and then two more questions, and I'm going to pass the mic, and then you're going to go next. Jane, you have a question too.
Archbishop, thank you. I really enjoyed your talk. Unfortunately, I don't know the novels, although she did give a commencement address to the college when I worked. My question is: have you given her a solution to the problem of predestination? Where she finds freedom, spark of freedom in that. How do you avoid a kind of swerve to antinomianism or a kind of absurdity? Especially since we're asking these questions about the mind.
Very good question, I think. The notion that the judgment of God is unknowable can lead you in at least two directions. The one that I think you're expressing the historical anxiety about, antinomianism, would say, because the judgment of God is unknowable, it's as likely that I'm right as that I'm wrong. A more Calvinist approach would say, it's as likely that I'm wrong as that I'm right. in other words, simply talking about predestination or the unknowability of God does not let you off the self-questioning. And antinomianism, I think, would be very inimical to the way in which these novels and Robinson's general approach work, because it's quite clear that part of what is happening in Jack is a self-awareness that's just not open to absolution. It's a truthful self-awareness. Jack is a sad, confused, damaged, and damaging person for all the gentleness and warmth that comes out in his personality. And that's very clear. But what he cannot do is, as it were, let go of that for the sake of absolution. Equally, his father, another sweet, gentle soul, can't let go of his own sameness. So judgment, questioning, all that comes in. You don't know how God sees the other, or even yourself. But rather than letting you off, that confronts you again and again with what is God saying? The God who is, you know, very much the God of the Epistle to the Romans and the rest of Scripture too.
And one more question, Jake.
Archbishop Williams, thank you for your thoughts. Mine is more of perhaps a comment than a question. And if possible, I thought that I heard, I wanted to say something about the shape of your thinking in this, that reminded me of your writing on the icon of the Virgin of Loving Kindness in your small book on icons. And before you got to Calvin, when you were talking about never a possession, always a presence, and it seems to me that that movement that you're seeing in the novel is one that, at least that I saw in the icon, thanks to your comments, which is of the Christ child never fully grounded or held by the Virgin, but always a presence.
A presence.
And it just goes on.
Thank you. Thank you very much indeed. That's very illuminating. I never know much about the shape of my thinking, I'm afraid. I can remember the very first time I lectured in Germany, which was a good many years ago, rather terrifying event. I had dinner with the faculty, theological faculty at Bonn afterwards, and I remember one of the professors pushing back his chair at a salient point, fixing me with his eagle eyes and saying, "So, Professor Williams, was ist Ihre methodologische Ausgangspunkt? What is your methodological starting point?" I remember sitting there feeling a complete idiot. So thank you for helping me see some shape, even the methodologische Ausgangspunkt, perhaps.
Let's thank